welcome everybody. This is the podcast, ULP, which, as you all know, stands for Usually Loud Players. Tonight on the show, we're talking to Ryan, Chris, Jeff, and Corey about Mysterium, a Polish game that has a reprint in English by Fantasy Flight. We're going to briefly touch on some sports games, especially with it being March and with basketball going on, as well as baseball's spring training. In the third segment, we're going to talk a little bit about the old game Entdecker, or the old games Entdecker when we get to it. Then we'll do our wrap-up and talk about what we're going to do for next week. But first, let's do a quick round of introductions. Say hi, Ryan, and we'll go around the room and just say a little bit about yourself.
Right. All right, so I'm Ryan Johnson. I'm a designer by trade. I've got a couple game credits. I haven't done a whole lot in the game industry. I'm kind of busy with other stuff. The main credit I think I probably have is Dungeon Roll, which Chris designed. Been gaming for about 12, 15 years, seriously, with pretty much you guys, and just kind of enjoy gaming with these folks.
All right, Chris?
I'm Chris Starden. I'm a published game designer with Dungeon Roll. I also help run Geekway to the West at a convention in St. Louis, Missouri every year. Been board gaming and gaming in general for most of my life.
Jeff.
Jeff Rupert. I've been gaming for a few years. Say like the late 90s is when I started to play non-Walmart board games, I guess. And then I met Ryan, and I blame him for my obsession with gaming now.
Cool.
All 25 of your games?
That's close to 200 now.
Is it 200?
Yeah.
Nice. Good work. Corey.
I am Corey Evan Wright. I am a complete gaming noob, basically. I had my stint with Magic back in like 96, but that's about it for me. I'm pretty new to the field, but I'm very interested in gaming. And when I met Ryan, it was like, hey, this guy can show me the ropes. So that's where I'm at now.
Excellent. And I'm Scott. I sort of run ludography.net. As the tagline says, ludography.net, there should be something up here by now. I've been gaming for over a decade now, extension collection of games. I've had work in and out of the game industry. And this podcast is sort of part of a larger effort to do something creative and try to get some new thoughts out there, or just to have a little piece of discussion on the podcast scape. All right, so the first thing we're going to be talking about is Mysterium. Mysterium is a Polish game that was originally under the name, Chris, you get to correct me on this one, Tajmenitsi Domostwo.
I think that was terrible. No, what they told us was Tajemnicze Domostwo.
Tajemnicze Domostwo. Cool.
Yes, that is what Ignacy taught us.
Oh, yes, name dropping. Thank you. You're the best.
You're welcome. Don't trip over that name.
But it's a 2013 game by Oleksandr Nevsky. Can you do these ones too, Chris?
No, I don't know how to pronounce them.
Okay. Oleksandr Nevsky and Oleg Sidorenko, possibly. Yeah. They're written down in front of me. I just can't pronounce for... Polish is not something I can do very well. Mysterium is a game for 2 to 7 players, currently printed in the U.S. and English by Fantasy Flight Games. Before the show, we talked about it, and Chris has the most experience with Mysterium, or at least in its previous Polish edition. So I'm going to let Chris talk a little bit about overview for the game, and then we'll get into just sort of discussing the game.
Sure. So Mysterium, like you said, is a game for 2 to 7 players. It really works best with a larger group, I think, you know, anywhere from 4 to 7. It's a co-op game. One of you plays a ghost, basically, that is haunting this mansion that all the other players are staying in, and you are giving them all dreams. You have very specific dreams that you have to give everyone, and based on the clues you give them, which are really beautifully illustrated cards, much in the vein of how Dixit is illustrated. They're large cards, you hand them out, and those are the dreams. And based on those cards, you have to figure out which of the items that they're trying to get you to guess that is on the tableau. So there's 3 different categories. Basically, how the murder was committed, where the murder was committed, and who committed it. And so, as you go through the game, the ghost can't say anything at all. They can only give you these dreams, and the players have to work together to try and guess where the ghost is pointing everyone to their dreams. And hopefully, by the end, everyone figures out their dreams all the way through, and then there's one final round, if there's still time left, to give everyone kind of a group dream, figure out who actually did it. you know, which is predetermined ahead of time by the ghost. The edition I have is the Polish edition. The art is beautiful in it. It's very stripped down, though, especially when compared to the Asmodee version, which has some new art, which I don't necessarily like, but it kept a lot of the old art. But the caricatures, I like the older art better. But it does come with a big folder display, kind of like a Dungeon Master screen. You know, it folds out into it's a trifold, and then you can put everyone's information all together there instead of having them either face down, or what I did is I bought some business card holders to use for mine. You know, personal set that's still in the box. Overall, the game is a huge hit with everyone I've played it with. It's a great family game. Everyone seems to pretty much get it right away. I'm really surprised that we haven't seen it in places like Target by now, because I think it's a great family game and it could really take off, and I'm not sure why it hasn't made its way yet. That's pretty much it. That's the overview. Very simple, very easy, very family-friendly. Except for the murder theme, I guess. You know, so yeah, that may be what's keeping it out of Target.
It was a murder like a century ago, so that's, you know.
Yeah. So it's okay to
make jokes. We don't care about those.
Right.
A quick follow-up question, though. When you say that you're surprised that it's not appeared in Target or other mass merchant retailers, do you think that it's possible that it hasn't caught a mainstream audience, or no large retailers picked it up, partly because of its asymmetric nature, as well as the fact that one of the players, the player who is the ghost, has to remain silent for the entire game?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of any mainstream game, really, that has asymmetry in it, now that you think of it. You know, in all the games that I can think of, everybody is pretty much equal, right? They're all players, they're all something, and yeah, you're right, that may be something that is too new for general audiences, but I don't know. I'm starting to think that people are wanting different things out of games, because if you look at Target shelves now, you know, you see a lot of new stuff, and it may be old to us, but, you know, I'm hearing it from people saying, hey, I played Ticket to Ride. Hey, I played Settlers. You know, like, that's... And Pandemic. Pandemic's another one. Pandemic strikes me as something that's very complex, and yet there it is at Target. So, complex for that kind of audience, I mean.
Right.
I got you. Just being condescending. That's cool. But I was going to say that also, I do see that the parallels between Mysterium and Dixit, that there are parallels there, and that if you can play Dixit, that Mysterium is not that far of a leap. So I agree with you as well that I think it probably would be a good choice for a mass merchant.
Well, and you see, like, Mysterium showed up early. I mean, as soon as Asmodee, you know, re-released it, it showed up in Barnes & Noble, which, at least around here, tends to be, you know, partially a precursor for it showing up in Target. So I can see Target taking a shot at trying this, you know, trying a game like Mysterium out, because it's got good hype, it sells well on Amazon, and like Chris said, it you know, I watched some different makeup of, you know, different groups with different kinds of makeup from our game group playing it, and, you know, you kind of sometimes you expect to see people kind of hit a wall on some of those games, and they didn't. So I think we might see it in the mass market.
Jeff, we've played Mysterium together. What are your thoughts on Mysterium as a game? And how do you enjoy being the ghost?
I love being the ghost. Everyone gets me. Except for Scott. No, I liked it. I thought it was actually pretty difficult, obviously, trying to get people to understand the clues I was giving them. Scott. I don't know. It's pretty fun. It's a game I definitely would not own, because for my gaming crowd, I have a small gaming crowd here in Nashville, and I don't think I could get the right people together for it. Not that they don't have the patience for it or anything, but I don't know, they just seem to want to play other types of games. It's one I'll definitely play again, obviously not as the ghost. I'm sorry, Scott.
What I do recall about when we did play together, when you were playing as the ghost, and I found this as well when I've played as the ghost, is that because you have a limited hand, you end up cycling through it a lot, and it seemed like that was where you were encountering a lot of frustration, is that as the ghost, you have a very limited body of things to work with. So what do you think about that as the game mechanism?
Yeah, it's definitely puts a big limitation on it. Like, the guy doesn't have a hat, so here's a card with a hat blowing away in the wind. And that's what I'm thinking, but you're seeing the card that says, oh, there's a hat, so this guy obviously has a hat. So that definitely puts a damper on it, trying to express what you're thinking, what you're trying to get across.
Follow up on this as the ghost, because, again, as the ghost, you can't actually say anything, but you do have to sit by and listen to all of the logic chains that all of the group goes through. So what were some of the things that were going through your mind while the group was analyzing the body of cards that you were passing out, but completely missing the points that you were trying to hit?
Well, let's point out, too, that Scott was the only one having trouble with...
Scott was the only one having trouble, and I think that...
Scott was also the only one who was getting 7 cards a turn, which I'm not sure is supposed to happen in the game.
I think because you were having trouble understanding what I was trying to get across was adding to my frustration, and so therefore I was trying to give you a lot more information, but it was way too overwhelming for you.
Well, and I'll say this too, because that highlights one of my favorite things about it as an experience game, because that game where Jeff was a ghost, that was a miserable loss.
Yeah.
But I laughed so hard listening to Jeff explain his... Because we started keeping track of the dreams he was giving Scott, and listening to him explain what the correlation was on each card had me in stitches. I mean, I couldn't breathe. I was laughing so hard.
It made sense to me.
That is fair.
No one else in the world would have got that.
Now, Corey, you had this on your list of games you were interested in even before you kind of started hanging out with us. What about Mysterium that you had seen or read kind of put that on your list?
It was totally the art style. It caught my eye on a shelf. I was down at Tate's Gaming Satellite in Florida, and I saw it on the shelf next to, like, Ring Out Your Dead, I think, and both of them caught my eye. I just picked it up, and I looked at the back, and the card art and the box art is, obviously, that's the whole point, but it caught my eye, and I wasn't, at that point, I really wasn't into gaming at all. And that was, like, the first time I was, like, I looked up a game and put it on my wish list, and I was like, this looks like it could be fun. And also thinking about, this might be a good family game to, you know, get my wife and friends involved. So, yeah, I mean, that was it. I didn't have any knowledge of it. And I think once I looked it up, I found a blog post about it, read through the gameplay. It sounded like a good time. And it was a really unique mechanic, too. So, just appealed to me on that level.
Yeah, the art, you know, like Chris said, I think I prefer the Polish version as well. But even deeper than Dixit, in Mysterium, you're really, like, you're going over each of these illustrations, both from the illustrations the ghost has given you and the depictions of the characters, you know, implements of death or the locations. I mean, you're really searching for different pieces of those cards. So, it can be kind of a nice little trek into, you know, the art.
I know art for me is, like, a big thing as well. Like Corey was saying, like, you pick up a game and you see the art on stuff. Like, ELO games or Yellow games or however you say it, all of their stuff I'm a sucker for because I pick it up and I'm just like, oh, this looks amazing. So I was going to ask Ryan, like, what is it about the two different Mysteriums, like, you like or don't like?
I haven't seen it. Like Chris, I haven't, you know, I haven't actually held the Asmodee Fantasy Flight version. The pieces I've seen online, Chris nailed it. It's a little bit more cartoony. It's more in that, it's actually a little bit, it's not quite as cartoony as Yellow tends to get, but they're definitely more of a caricature instead of a artistic depiction of a person or a place. It's, I mean, they're still well done.
I think it goes against the theme of the game. You know, it just doesn't fit with the overall tone of what's going on.
Yeah, because there are easily 200-300 pieces of art in this game. But, you know, that's a good point. The original Polish version, some of the art is pretty dark, you know, both in the tableau cards and the dream cards.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I do, Chris kind of mentioned it briefly, his business card stands are necessary for me to enjoy that game. Because I can't imagine playing as the ghost and not having basically those business cards prop everything up, you know, as a screen for that ghost player. And as the ghost, you know, the other thing I'll say about this game is it's one of those games where if you're not the ghost and you're getting frustrated because of the ghost player, you're like, I could do so much better, until you're sitting in that seat and you're just like, oh, crap, I
can't, pressure's on.
Stop going down the, you know, this. That one, he's missing a hat, but not that he has a hat, kind of a thing. So it was a great add-on that Chris came up with for that.
Excellent. Well, I enjoyed the times I've played Mysterium. I think it was a good get. I'm with Chris that I could definitely see it hitting a lot more mass market. Shifting gears real quick, let's move on to our second topic that we picked for this evening. With it being March coming up and the basketball tournament, as of the time of this recording, basketball tournament about to start, we were going to just briefly touch on some sports games. And I'm of the opinion that sports games are generally terrible. I tweeted last week that from my experience with sports games, too many people have tried to make a soccer simulation where they put down a grid board, add some players in, and then sprinkle terribleness on it. Or disappointment. I said disappointment. Yeah, they'd sprinkle disappointment. How is it, starting back over here with Corey, what experiences have you had with sports games? Are there sports games that you like?
No, I don't gravitate towards them because I'm not a sports guy. And I do remember seeing like some of the baseball style games back when I was younger, and I just never had any really real draw to them. I mean, that's I really don't have too much more to say about it, just because it's not something that I go for theme, and that's just not something that I would really gravitate towards ever.
I got you.
Yeah.
I got you. Jeff, how about you? Have you had much experience with sports games?
I was trying to think about that, and I actually went on BGG to look up sports games, and the stuff that popped up was like Formula Day and like Blood Bowl and Pitch Car, of all things. But then I got to thinking, like, Turf Master, that's technically a sports game.
True. That's a great good point.
That's a great game. But in general, like football and basketball and baseball and that kind of thing, no, I have no experience with those. I used to race BMX bikes, and at one point I'm like, I'm going to create a BMX board game. And I looked it up on Board Game Geek to see if there was any. And there was one. It was basically just like roll and move kind of thing.
And maybe that's my problem with sports games, is that it seems like you take something that's a real physical contest and that has a lot of elements going on with it, and then when you try to distill it down to a board game, you end up losing so much with it that there's nothing actually to play with anymore, is that you've basically taken a minor mechanism and then skinned the theme over the top of it and then tried to call that football or baseball or whatever, and that it ends up a little bit lacking. But I will say that I agree with you a little bit that as a horse racing game, I do really enjoy Turf Master. And that Battle Bowl, Blood Bowl. No, not Blood Bowl. I've never played Blood Bowl. Battle Ball, which is the Blood Bowl Beginner's Edition. Battle Ball is fairly okay for a children's game. I mean, you know, I played it with my young nephew, but I probably wouldn't pick it up to play it otherwise, because it is just an ersatz simulation of football. Chris, though, you've had some good experience with the WWE board game that you've really enjoyed. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Oh, sure.
Wrestling's a sport now?
Sports game. But, WWE Superstar Showdown is actually a decent game, a Gale Force 9 game. It's kind of got that rock, paper, scissors feel to it, but it has a tactical element where you're moving the wrestlers around the board and can do things and set yourself up for future moves, so... everyone I've played it with, even non-wrestling fans, have enjoyed it because it's quick and it just has lots of options and things.
Yeah, it has a lot of real-time kind of action in it, right?
Yeah. You kind of program your moves, kind of robo-rally-ish, and then you flip over at the same time and compare them and go from there. And speaking of other games, you know, like Turf Master is one of my favorite games, if you consider that a sports game. I think most racing games fall flat for me, but I really like Turf Master. I don't really like Formula Day. I do like, the GMT one, Thunder Alley. I like Thunder Alley. And as far as other genres, I've played a lot of, like, Pizza Box Baseball and football and, you know, those kinds of things. I really like the lighter sports games, I think. You know, things like Harry's Grand Slam Baseball. You know, just stuff that kind of captures the feel but doesn't really dig too deep down, like Status Pro Baseball, stuff like that. I just never could really get into. I did play a lot of Blood Bowl in my youth, and I really enjoyed it. I would love to see a treatment like Blood Bowl from a real football perspective, but I'm just not sure there's enough there. Part of the fun of Blood Bowl is, you know, having a treant pick up a snotling and throw him downfield, you know what I mean? And that kind of stuff just doesn't happen in regular football.
Not yet. At least,
well, maybe in the CFL, but yeah, not in the NFL.
We are constantly experiencing games that have unique mechanics that are applied. I mean, there's some really smart designers out there that apply mechanics in really smart ways to different genres. How much do you guys think it's more the fact that, you know, as a gaming hobby, we're not necessarily quite so sports-minded? You know, is it just that we don't identify with sports games? I mean, I know the team competitive sports are hard to simulate, like Chris said. You know, Harry's Grand Slam and Bottom of the Ninth, I actually really enjoy. So there's some bluffing elements and some, you know, dice to kind of change it up, and you've got individual player stats. But, I mean, how much of that is that gamers as a whole right now in the hobby don't tend to gravitate towards sports?
I'm not so... Well, I don't know. I really don't have enough background in what where gamers are coming from to speak to that. But I can just say from my perspective, like, I'm not a really big sports fan, but I played football in high school. I watch football on television, but playing something like 3M Challenge Football is not quite football. As much as I like Battle Ball, Battle Ball is still not quite football. Battle Ball is HeroScape that happened on a football field, kind of, where you rolled a few dice and moved the ball around a little bit. But it's not it's still not quite the action of football. But I'm going to slide off topic, or slide away from the topic here. One of the Ryan, I think you put this on the discussion list. One of the few sports games that actually I do feel like sort of captures the feel of it is something like Waykick.
Yeah.
Like Waykick and the sort of the back and forth Waykick and what I think it's Way Hockey is the other one or something like that, even though it's pretty much the exact same game again with different components.
Yeah, these are huge wooden games, kind of they're as big as the old electronic or magnetized football games that, you know, players are actually manipulating wooden soccer players, or what's the Sabudio or
Sabudio is soccer?
Yeah, Sabudio.
Sabudio. Now, if you actually Google guys that know what they're doing playing Sabudio, that is amazing.
That's true.
A flick game where you're actually flicking these little like soccer players that are on these half dome pieces, and they wobble, and like you'll see them count out their steps like in seconds, and then they flick the ball. I mean, that can be amazing, but I mean, there's an element of skill there that I don't have.
Yeah,
and I've played it before. It's pretty fun. There's actually a whole Sabudio line. Like, there's cricket and rugby and field hockey. Like, and it's that entire flicking genre, you know, that seems well suited for sports.
So yeah, so maybe I came into this this discussion a bit jaded, and now you guys you have brought up some ones that some games that I have seen before, maybe tinkered with a little bit, and I have to agree with you that what I've owned Sabudio. I've tried to play it. I'm obviously not at a level where I'm playing live and you know, got my finger down and more or less going back and forth in a timed game, but at least a little bit I tinkered with it. I enjoyed it a fair bit, and I think that's something that almost does hit the representation of a real simulation of a soccer game. So that's pretty fair.
Well, and Chris, to your point, it's interesting too that I think that there's a broader general appeal to some of those smaller, you know, lighter sports games. Like street soccer is a great little two player game.
You mean roll sixes and win?
There's at least some movement, but yes. There was another one I was thinking of too. What street soccer? Slapshot.
Yeah, Slapshot. I love Slapshot.
But it's, I mean,
card game.
Yeah, yes. It's not really.
I know that it's hockey themed. I don't know that there's anything.
There is
in
a hockey theme on it, and there. Are...
Yeah. I mean, it's very beer and pretzels, you know. Yes. But it's fun to play with a bunch of people and do that kind of tournament style game with it.
I mean, I buy that a little bit, but I mean, to call that game a sports game or call that a hockey game, that's a bit and bluff numbers.
Yes,
game.
Yes, you could retheme that to be sure. Dance Moms.
I mean. Because it's a Kinesia game, right? It's got the numbers 1 through 10?
0 through 9.
I'm just joking. Because it's not a Kinesia game, is it? Or is it?
No. I don't think so.
I'm just saying, yeah. But it might as well be for as close as it is to hockey. Yeah,
I think one of my favorite memories of a sports game is electronic football as a kid. Did you guys ever play that as a kid? Like the little board and you got your players and they're just like randomly, chaotically dancing around. And you're like, maybe I'll score a goal.
I never had a chance to play those when I was younger, and actually getting a hold of one of those today that's not all rusted out is a rich man's proposition. I keep waiting for someone like Darden to find it and put it in his pinball room.
My dad has a copy. My dad has a decent one down in our basement. And it's just, you know, it's a giant vibrator, right?
Right.
I mean, started Jeff's love of the game, but yeah.
Right. I did go to my grandma's house to play this game, by the way.
One last thing before we wrap up on sports games. Just sitting there, and since you mentioned Rich Man's proposition of having the old electronic football, I had forgotten my acquisition from a couple months ago. Skittle Bowl, I guess, is technically a sports game. It's not themed on sports. It's a sport itself, and that one's actually pretty damn fun.
Bowling is a sport I'm more physically suited for.
Yeah. Well, any sport that you can both smoke and get drunk while you're playing it and still do pretty well. That's the best sport in my book. So darts, bowling, and polo.
By the way, there is no good golf game, which I'm still not happy about. You'd think there would be one by now. Like, at least one.
I'll tell you one that is more accurate to golf, but is also way more terrible than anything else. Golf Masters by Goldsieber, because if you're like me and you got twitchy hands, you'll hit the little puff ball and knock it right off the table every single time.
Oh
yeah, Tennis Masters too is also just as terrible from Goldsieber.
Right.
Both of those are air quotes real sports games. And they are just awful to play.
At the end of this discussion, let's do a round off. Do you even want to see more sports games? Is that something you look for?
I mean,
don't.
if I'm going to play games, especially getting into the hobby, like, there's so many other themes that I'm more interested in, why would I go to sports, you know? There's so many different things you can explore. For me, it's just, it's not even worth looking at it.
If somebody could turn the Golden Tee video game into a dexterity game, I would totally buy it.
Yeah, I would like to see more. I would like to see, smaller sports covered. You know, I think football and baseball have had their share. You know, I'd like to see people take a real crack at things like golf or bowling or whatever, you know, to see what could happen.
Well, there is caveman curling, so that's a game.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be a dexterity game that we could do for arm wrestling, over-the-top style.
Yeah, everybody's a character from over-the-top, and we drive trucks and meet. And,
yeah.
Break arms.
But only if you're a loser.
Yeah. All right, so moving on from sports, we're going to talk about old game. The selection this week, Ryan made a list of some of his favorite games. I wouldn't necessarily put this in my top 10, but this is one where in my Venn diagram, I would say that I enjoy this game also pretty well, and that is Endecker, a classic game by Klaus Teuber, who's most famous for Settlers of Catan. I don't know if there's ever been any veracity put to it, but the rumor was that when Klaus Teuber came up with Settlers of Catan, he also came up with Lohenhurts and Endecker at the same time, and that all three games were supposed to be independent aspects of one larger game. So in Endecker would be the first stage where you explore and you find islands, then Settlers would be you settle the islands, and then Lohenhurts
was second, though, because you fight for the kingdoms and then you build the kingdoms.
Oh, okay. Well, in whichever order that it was, the idea of putting all of those together would make a ridiculous game that would make me claw my eyes out. So I'm glad that they were made into separate games. Most people are familiar with Endecker, at least most Americans are familiar with Endecker, through the Mayfair version, which is actually the second game that was called Endecker. The original game came out in the mid-90s from Goldsieber. It was merely called Endecker. The game got a little bit of retooling and then came out again in 2001 from Kosmospiele as Die Neuen Endecker, which means the new Endecker. By the way, Endecker means discoverer or explorer. Mayfair picked it up and just called that Endecker, which makes it a little bit confusing because it's just called Endecker, but it's a redo of it's the Americanization of the German new discoverer. Ryan, you want to? This was one of your picks. You want to talk a little bit about Endecker?
Yeah. So this is a game that got put on the table early on in my introduction to Euro games or hobby games, and because in the game you're sailing a ship, your ship, and you're discovering these islands as you go. And each of the islands, each tile has either one side of it with an island or an island that it's two sides, kind of a little bit like Carcassonne. Has cities and stuff. And I had played Carcassonne, but watching the board turn into this nautical map of amazing islands, and not only just the islands, but a maze of them. And at the same time, having this contest, you know, with the other players where you're trying to get to certain islands, to claim them. You're kind of seeing islands chain together. So you're really trying to forecast, you know, can I help this island chain in with these other islands over here and got a settlement as well and kind of take control of this. It was just really one of those games that at the end of it, I sat back, really appreciated what the board looked like at the end of it, and just had a blast playing it. And I mean, this is not a game really that has very tight finishes, I don't think. I think usually there's some distance between the last and the first player. And I know the new Endecker really tried to take care of that with kind of a side metagame, or not really a metagame, but a secondary minigame. The strategy of it is really clear. It's easy to pick up on. Your decisions are really pretty interesting as far as I thought. So yeah, it was a great game for me. What do you guys think?
I just looked it up because I wasn't familiar with it. And I mean, for me, if you throw in nautical theme and exploration, and I'm sold. So it looks really awesome to me. And I agree that a finalized board looks pretty neat. Even in play, I mean, with parts of the underneath showing, it looks great. So I'm really interested in it. I'm kind of wondering why you guys haven't offered to play it with me yet.
Because I have 700 games. It's going to take some time.
Was the 2001 version the Exploring New Horizons?
Yes. That's what the tagline that Mayfair put on. Endecker Exploring New Horizons is the full name from the Mayfair version.
I forget. I think I asked Ryan about Euro games, like what I should get, and he said I should get Endecker, and I looked it up, like, which one? He said Exploring New Horizons. I liked it when I played it with people who had played it before. When I tried to play it with a bunch of noobs, it didn't go so well, and for some reason, every time I play it, no matter who I'm playing it with, I always forget about the little huts over on the side of the board, and I'm like so concentrated on what's going on the sea part of the board. Always forget about putting people in huts or whatever you do over there. But I eventually ended up selling it, so it's not my place. collection anymore.
Chris, what about you?
I've never played it.
What?
Nope. Never played it. You've never put it in front of me.
We'll have to change that at Bubba Geek this year.
Yeah, we'll give it a shot. I tell you what, I'll bring Noyan and Decker and Decker. We'll play them both, and then you can complain about each.
Simultaneously?
You'll play a left-handed and Decker and a right-handed Noyan and Decker, and then figure out which one is best as you play.
All right.
Scott, what do you think?
I will do that.
I like it. I like it well enough. I don't think it necessarily hits on my top list. I do agree with you that I like sort of the sea exploring mechanism of it. A lot of the way the islands break down is that it works off of almost an area majority type of mechanism. So you're dropping settlers on there, or you're dropping forts, or you're dropping a third thing that I can't remember what the hell it is. And so, and that both is used to win the influence of the island, which gets you points, but then also, depending on where you put some of your pieces down, it sort of blocks sea lanes, or it causes a monetary penalty to some of the other players that decide to pass by there.
Yeah, I think it's settlers, outposts, and then like citadels forts.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, yeah, settlers out. Yeah, so those are fairly entertaining elements. And as well, the money management aspect of the game is rather novel, just because that there are no actions in the game that really make you money so much. But when one player decides that he or she needs more money, you roll a die, and then that player gets the number on the die, and then all the other players get one more than that. So every time somebody needs cash, they're actually providing slightly more cash than everybody else. So it does have that rather interesting money management aspect to it. And then, as Jeff, like you were just saying, that forgetting about the huts that are on the side, that's also that was an ad for the new Endecker, the new Discoverer that wasn't in the original one. But that's also that's an interesting aspect of the game, but one that I feel is a little bit weirdly shoehorned in. What you make in those huts can win you the game, even though you didn't participate in a lot of the rest of the game, because it's a shell game of figuring out which huts are the ones that are worth the most, and then getting all the influence you can on them. Because if you can pick up two or three 15-point huts, then it didn't matter that you didn't make any points. It doesn't matter as much that you didn't make any points on the board, because you won the game by just running the huts on the side.
Yeah, I feel like these goods huts that are on the side of the board that were added, I feel like that's a mechanic they must have added, because in a four-player game, you can find yourself in a position where you really can't compete with someone who's jumped out ahead of you and claimed islands. Instead, you just start racing to find new islands, place settlers, and then get them over into huts. You know, I've seen some players make up ground in those huts, but it tends to become an artificial point system. So, but yeah, take a look. Anybody that's interested and thinks nautical or not so much puzzly kind of games, but I mean, there is a puzzle element to figuring out how you can get these connections to be made. Take a look at Endecker. It's, if nothing else, it's interesting in that it's tied to settlers.
Yeah, I agree.
How many players is it?
It maxes at four.
Is it two to four?
Two to four, and the game on the back does assert that it's also good for two players. At least the Germans feel that. Okay, so that about wraps it up for our discussion for Endecker. We're going to slide right into our last minute, the final thought for the evening. The question we determined for tonight was going to be, what game, if you found somewhere that was incomplete, would you spend a lot of time to hunt down all the pieces to try to make it complete? Either by trading with other people to find all the pieces you need, or if you had to go all the way, go so far as to have pieces made on a 3D printer. Ryan, you seem really excited about this one. Do you want to shoot at this one first?
Yeah, I mean, there are a million games out there. I don't thrift enough. I always want to, but I never seem to be in the right place at the right time. But, we talked in a previous episode about some of the ideal games. One that I've always been kind of interested in, and it's not even really so much of a game, it's called Bing Bang Boing. And essentially what it is it's really this marble maze kind of a thing where you set up this little ramp, and you set up these little trampoline things across the floor. It's a kind of an open-form game. And you launch these ball bearings down, and they'll jump from trampoline to trampoline into a little elevator arm kind of a mechanism, and then that switches the direction, and it sends it onto more trampolines. It's a really big game. I think the novelty for the toy element that Ideal is so well known for is really strong with this one. And it would be one of those games where I'd almost have to imagine you'd have to manufacture the diaphragms on the trampolines, because I mean, they were really these tight rubber molded pieces that I mean, in a game that's from 1970, I think, just would not be intact. But I would spend a lot of time. I've never even found the actual, you know, a junked out copy of it, but I would bite the bullet on that one.
Chris, how about you? What are your thoughts on what game would you spend an unreasonable amount of time to try to complete?
If I saw in a thrift store, I would probably say something like Star Wars Queen's Gambit, you know, something like that. From what I've seen of people who actually find them in the wild, they're usually missing a few pieces, some of the minis, some of the, you know, things, because they were largely viewed as toys, you know, because of all the minis, things like that. So they weren't treated the best. Something like that, something, one of those big, just ones with tons of pieces. Maybe even an old Talisman, one of the original copies of that. That would be another one that I would spend time pulling together.
Jeff, what about you? What game would you spend an unreasonable time to get together?
I've already kind of done this. Electronic Cops and Robbers. Is that what it was called?
Stop Thief.
Stop Thief, yeah, that one. I bought like two copies from you that were both like parted out kind of thing. And then I think Darden sent me some cards I was missing or some other pieces I was missing. And that just has like awesome sentimental value for me. Like growing up, I'd go to my grandma's house and she didn't even have the complete game. So I never actually played the complete game until we were at Geekway sitting outside playing it that one time. We had to look up like the translation or the electronic part on the phone kind of thing. But just going to my grandma's house and like playing around with just like the little electronic device and making the noises and acting like we were the cops and the robbers kind of thing. Just because of that, you know, when I found out you had a couple of copies of it, that's why I bought those.
Corey, what about you?
So I'm not into gaming, but I was just hunting through games and I found this Mystic Skull, the game of Voodoo, which I hadn't seen before. I've got a trip to New Orleans planned. I was just looking up for like Voodoo themed games. And it's definitely full of little pieces that I would imagine would be missing. Like, there's two little voodoo guys that you have to, you know, stab at the pins. And then there's, like, a little unique spinner with, like, a hanging skull on it. It just seems like one of those games that's probably going to have lost parts, but it seems like one that, I mean, I know you can get it on eBay, but it'd be worth hunting down and just find. It could be a good thrift store find. It'd be a really good one. It's just a unique old, ideal published game.
Nice. Yeah. I thought about this one, and the one that came to mind, and I don't even have, like, a real nostalgia for it, But I know what a lot of other people do is Fireball Island. I actually owned a copy for a short while, but I found it almost fits this exact question. I found it at thrift. It was missing a number of pieces. It was missing a couple cards. It was missing a couple of the bridges. I think it was missing a couple of fireballs. It was about half there. Probably could have spent the time to put it together over the course of a couple of years of like trying to call in favors and get parts from people. But ultimately, I ended up selling it, just cashing it out, and getting some cash for it from somebody else who wanted to take it onto the project. Like I said, I'm not nostalgic for it. It's one of those games that I think people of a certain age have a nostalgia for. And even if it is like a silly roll and move game, just that little bit of action of getting to put the marble at the top of the top of the mountain and roll it down and have it take out bridges and stuff, just sort of that very physical aspect of the game seemed kind of interesting.
It's a great screw your neighbor game.
Yeah, it's really impressive too on the table. Yeah, it looks good. I just looked up Bing Bang Boing and some guy who was doing a restoration on one. So if you ever find a copy, a good replacement for those latex things are dental dams from Amazon.
Oh, nice. I'm finally going to use for all those dental dams that
I've
been storing up.
That you've got that box in the garage, yeah.
I didn't even know dental dams were a thing one could buy.
Planned Parenthood providing game pieces.
All right, well, I think that about wraps us up for this show. Next show, we're going to talk about the game Codenames, which gets a lot of discussion about a sort of a mainstream party game. We're going to play a couple rounds of Who Got the Better Deal, where we're going to look at some trades and see, and basically just debate about between the games that were traded, who traded up and who traded down.
We're going to judge people.
We're going to judge people because we're judgy jerks. Finally, we're going to discuss one of my favorite games, Hab und Gut, which is a German game of minor market manipulation with a little bit of information thrown in. Yeah, so that's what we're going to be doing on the next podcast. Quick run around, everybody, like say where people can find your information and whatnot. I'm Scott. I am on Twitter at LudographyScott. I'm also on Twitter at Skellabone, and I run the website ludography.net.
You can find me, Ryan, on Twitter at OL_River_Johnson without the H. You can take a look at any of the art I've posted for various games at oldriverstudios.com.
The best place to find me is on Twitter at CB Darden.
I am Ludography Jeff on Twitter. That's a new account, so don't expect much so far.
And Corey can be found at BSublime on Twitter. That's B-E Sublime.
Thank you for listening. This has been the ULP, or the Usually Loud Players podcast, put on by Ludography.net. Ludography.net, there should be something up on here by now. Thanks for listening.
All together now.